Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the Editor-in-Chief. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Jen Cleland, who is the John Simpson Chair in Medical Education Research and the lead of the Medical Education Research and Clinical Communication Division of Medical and Dental Education at the University of Aberdeen. Jen and her colleagues have a paper coming out in the February 2016 issue of Medical Education entitled, What Do UK Doctors in Training Value in a Post? A Discrete Choice Experiment. Thanks, Jen, for taking the time to chat with me. I know it's quite late at night for you.
That's fine. This was actually quite convenient in terms of working around the working day and domestic commitments. So thank you for allowing me to log in so late.
My pleasure. I'll maybe warn our listeners that if we are interrupted by a wee voice, that we'll just take a pause and regroup. But I wanted the chance to talk with you because, as I've told you already, this paper strikes me as a very unique way of coming at an issue that's been bantered about for quite a long time now, thinking about how do we direct people to certain specialties, or even how do we better understand what's driving them, has implications for any number of workforce and other issues. But it's been studied so extensively, I wonder if I can start by just asking you, what was the gap that you saw in the literature? Why did you feel like there was still work that needed to be done in this domain?
Okay, that's interesting because my co-author Peter Johnson and I have been talking for quite some time about how we felt that this sounds terribly old, but how we felt that the medical students of today were different from those of previous generations. And workforce planning and careers decision making were our areas of interest. So we knew the literature quite well, and we knew that, you know, people have been looking at careers decision making since, the year dot, but certainly lots of work from about the 1970s. And we did do a full literature review that was commissioned before the paper. And we found that about 99% of the studies out there, no matter where they'd been carried out in the world or with what population of medical students or trainees, was an unvalidated questionnaire survey. And, I mean, we were guilty of that as well. We had done unvalidated questionnaire surveys to try and get a handle on what was going on. And, you know, they're fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with a survey. I think most people have used them at some point or another in their career. But we were looking at both our data and the data from these other studies thinking, there's something not quite right here. There's something missing. Yes, they're talking about gender differences. Okay, probably. They're talking about differences across different healthcare systems. Yes, I'm sure that is the case. But there just seemed to be a gap that we didn't really get a feel for the data that it was reporting, the kind of things that we heard from students and trainees about what was important to them when they worked or in their workplace. And we had wanted to work with colleagues from health economics for absolutely ages. But being health economists, they don't tend to collaborate unless there's funding. They're quite fiscally aware, is how I would put it. So we had engaged with them and they did want to work with us because workforce planning is one of their research themes. Just as an aside, the Health Economics Research Unit in Aberdeen is world famous. So our areas of expertise and interest overlap, but we had to wait till we got the funding, and then we were lucky enough to get the funding from NHS Education Scotland. And that allowed us to sit down with the health economists with our knowledge of the literature, but also with our knowledge of medical students and trainees and go, you know, there's something missing. And they made us work with them quite closely. This took much longer than you would think to develop these attributes that are in our discrete choice experiment, looking at what is it that's important to students and trainees when they're looking for a training post or when they're looking for the first fully trained post.
Before we get into the details of discrete choice experiments and how they work, your phrase fiscally aware strikes me as being something that's quite fundamental to think about with this paper, and that you state that one of your aims is to examine the strength of preferences in terms of monetary value. Was that decision guided by any particular perspective on needing to do that in order to get valid responses, as you said, or is that purely the economists believing that everything comes down to dollars?
Well, they are quite reductionist. But actually, no, it's an artifact of the methodology. There has to be a monetary value because of the nature of the methodology so that you can put a kind of percentage value on things. So it's about weightings. And so if you have the monetary attribute, then you can work out precise weightings in terms of value. And in lots of studies, those are actually expressed in pounds, shillings and pence. But in our study, because of what we were looking at, it was more about percentage values. But there are statements such as doctors would take significantly less salary, say 30% less salary, to work in a job that had excellent working conditions compared to one that had poor working conditions. That's not to say that if you said to a junior doctor, oh, well, look, we'll cut your wages substantially, but hey, it'll be a really nice place to work. You know, it's not really going to happen in reality. But what it is it gives you a kind of concrete notion of the strength of these preferences.
And so is the question posed to participants in this sort of study literally, what would you pay or what would you trade off to have or to lose certain things? Or how is it that somebody's able to express that dollar value in a meaningful way?
Okay, it's about trade-offs. That's exactly what it is. So when you give people choices, and I mean, our actual example where working conditions, as I've just said, geographical location, which is a big issue in the UK at the moment, because there's lots of underfilled posts in certain geographical areas, opportunities for spouse and partner, and so on and so forth. But for each of those, you explain what the attribute is so that to try to make sure that everybody's responding in the same way, using the same definition. But then they have to make decisions about very important, not so important, not at all important, or worth 20% more or 20% less in terms of importance. So the respondents have to trade off the values. And when you get a discrete choice question, it's all about trade-offs. They're used an awful lot in health services research. And I remember as a patient getting an enormous questionnaire from my practice asking me to trade off things about whether it would be seeing a doctor or a pharmacist for certain things. And that was actually a very interesting experience because the questionnaire that was sent to me as a patient was so long that I, a researcher, gave up halfway through and put it in the bin, which is really bad. When we designed the one that we used, we did it in such a way that we could use the minimum length that was feasible so that we could try and encourage a good response rate. Because I knew that your average medical student will get bored quite quickly over something that's actually quite time consuming to fill in. And that's fair enough.
Right.
So we took that into account. My personal experience did influence the length of the questionnaire to the extent that it could. We had these attributes and we had the different weightings. And then the health economist put that into a model so that every option was offered. And half the sample had 9 options and the other half had another 9 options. And that covered all the bases.
Right. And obviously the details we're going to have to direct people to the paper for because there are quite a few details. As you said, this is used extensively other places. I've only ever seen one previous paper in medical education that used the technique. Did using it largely reinforce the findings from the literature that you mentioned you had previously reviewed on this topic? Or did it lead you down a different path with respect to what came to the forefront as being particularly important?
It gave us new information. I think that was what was so interesting. As I said earlier, Peter and I were so convinced that the literature didn't touch on the things that we felt were important to students from the reports and the conversations we were having with them. And that very much seemed to be about working conditions. And in fact, if you open the British medical press, there's endless discussions about working conditions and specialties not filling up because they have antisocial shifts and so on. So we knew that this was important. So our discrete choice experiment was based on everything that we found in the literature, plus this working conditions definition. And what the way things came out was that locality, geographical locality, working conditions and opportunities for partner or spouse were top, generally speaking. And it's maybe worth mentioning that this was a general survey of all trainees. So these people could range in age from about 22 to about 35. And one of the things we really want to do in the future is try and do it by stage of training, because it might well be that people have different preferences depending on precisely where they are in the training pathway and also in the lifetime pathway, because you would think that working conditions and opportunities for spouse, for example, may be more important when you're 30 odds and you're thinking about settling down somewhere with your partner and finding schools for your kids and being able to share the domestic load than they might be when you're 22 and none of this is particularly on your radar.
Right, and that leads to the obvious conclusion that some of these things are modifiable and some aren't, right? The stage of life that one is at, there's not much that we as educators or as an institution is going to be able to do to fix that. So in terms of the implications coming out of this work, you already suggested that you wouldn't advise people to treat your data as saying we can cut your wage by 30% by improving the working conditions. But what should people take away from these data in terms of how to do their job better as health professions?
Okay, well, I think there's two points that we've been making. And in fact, this has been a really interesting study because I've been invited to talk about it all over the UK because it is such a big issue. And the two points that I try to make are we can't change locality. General practices and hospitals are located where they're located. We cannot move Aberdeen Royal Infirmary from Aberdeen to put it somewhere nice in London or a nice zone of Edinburgh. We are where we are. And the other thing that's relevant is where people are from. So medical students and trainees, as a general rule, want to go home, inverted commas, at some point in their careers. So again, that's maybe something we look at in terms of recruiting people to medicine. But that's an aside. What we can do is change the working conditions. We can't change where the hospital is or the general practice is, but we can look at making sure that there are excellent working conditions in as many practices and hospital units as possible. And that seems to be the message that is getting through. And we've had various studies funded since this work, and they've been looking at making improvements in clinical learning environments. So there's a recognition that addressing working conditions is the way to attract trainees. And it's quite interesting because what we've seen is that in environments where they have invited the consultants or the training programme directors, whatever the people in charge of education, which I appreciate that what they're called is different in different countries, if you sit down with trainees and residents and say, okay, what is it that you find most stressful about the job? Okay, let's work together to see how we can address this within the boundaries of our working time directives, within the boundaries of delivering a service. And actually just involving people seems to make a big difference. In our emergency medicine department, for example, they got the trainees involved in the rota and they still have to cover the service. And there's still weekends and there's still rather horrible night shifts. But actually now people feel that it's fair and everybody's kind of sharing the load and they're working much more as a team. So the discrete choice experiment, I think, has been a springboard for people saying, OK, let's look at our working conditions. Let's try to identify what it is that really bothers people and let's see how we can address this with the resources that we have.
So is the next study to look more specifically at how people would trade off different aspects of working conditions? Or do you feel like it is really at the point of having to tailor and define for each individual what's particularly important for them in their context?
Ooh, okay. Well, I think there's several studies. I think there's a whole career here, Kevin. One, we want to look at medical students. Well, we have already looked at medical students. I'm just analysing that data at the moment. We have data from 7 UK medical schools, all the final years, to see what their preferences are. And then we want to look across specialties and across particular points in the training pathway, particularly the points where people make big decisions. So in the UK system, when you go from foundation year 2 to the first year of core specialty or GP training and so on and so forth. So try to tease out what's going on at different points in time and in different, not different units, but different specialties. And one of the reasons for that in terms of using discrete choice experiments is they are quantitative, they are statistical models. You need a certain number of participants. So we want to carry on doing that quantitative side. But in terms of looking more at the individualistic side, which is one of the things you referred to, we're actually carrying out some qualitative studies looking at the process of change in departments where the working conditions were known to be poor.
That sounds great and very forward-looking, and as a result, it's probably a good place for us to wrap up because it leaves us with some anticipation of what's to come. Very happy that you have an entire career worth of research ahead of you on this topic, although I know that you're busy with many, many things. Thank you for your time, and I'm sure all the listeners and I look forward to seeing what comes next. Just to sign off, I'll remind people listening that I've been speaking with Jen Cloland about a paper that's coming out in the February 2016 issue of Medical Education entitled "What Do UK Doctors and Training Value in a Post? A Discrete Choice Experiment." Thanks again for listening and forward to chatting with you again.
Oh, well, thanks very much.